Shalom, welcome to ASJTF. This is Chaim ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chasdai Pesach ben Dov, Meir ben Yecheskel, and Yosef ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers this week, I want to speak about the insane decision of the evil Netanyahu government in Israel to release yet another 104 Muslim Nazi terrorist mass murderers from Israeli prisons. First of all, it's a disgrace that any Muslim terrorist mass murderers are in Israeli prisons. All of them should be killed. You should get whatever information you can get out of them, whatever intelligence information you can get, and then they should be executed. All Muslim terrorists captured by Israel should be killed. Just like they murder innocent Jewish men, women, and children and babies, they should get the same sentence that they want to mete out to innocent people. All of them should be killed. But Israel doesn't do that. Instead, Israel puts them in so-called prisons that are really like luxury hotels. In these prisons, they have air-conditioned rooms. They have cable television. They have the ability to listen to their disgusting music. They have prayer 5 times a day, special meals, visits all the time from all types of people. And they receive, in addition to all of that, cell phones and other types of special little goodies. It's literally like a hotel. By the way, the conditions I've described for you, air conditioning, cable television, cell phones, special meals, prayer 5 times a day, those conditions do not exist in any American prison. No American prison would ever allow conditions like that. Only insane Israel does this for the Muslim Nazi terrorist mass murderers of innocent Jewish men, women, and children. And that's not enough. Then, a short time after they're arrested, a couple of years after they're arrested, they're released as gestures to the Muslim world. Thousands upon thousands of Muslim Nazi terrorist mass murderers have been released from Israeli prisons by successive Israeli governments over the years. Most of them have been released by Likud governments, not by left-wing governments. Most of the terrorists that have been released by Likud governments, by the phony right, not by the left. And here we have the phony right again, the Netanyahu regime, deciding in the past 24 hours that they're going to release yet another 104 Muslim Nazi terrorist mass murderers as a gesture. What's the purpose of the gesture? The Israeli government is begging the PLO Fatah terrorists, Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, and the PLO Fatah terrorists to return to the negotiating table. And in fact, as a result of all of these gestures, negotiations are beginning tonight in Washington. What's the purpose of the negotiations? The purpose of the negotiations is to negotiate Israeli national suicide, God forbid. That's the goal. To get Israel to go back to the pre-1967 borders that are only 6 to 9 miles wide. To go back to borders that even Abba Ibn, an extreme left-wing foreign minister from the Socialist Labor Party, described as Auschwitz lines, Holocaust lines, suicide lines. That's the goal of the negotiations. That's what Secretary of State John Kerry and the Obama administration have promised the PLO Fatah terrorists in writing. They promised them in writing that that is the basis of these negotiations and that they will pressure Israel to agree to these terms. And by the way, the outlines of an agreement are already clear to all sides. Netanyahu has already agreed to the general outlines. What are the general outlines of an agreement? A so-called Palestinian state will be created, even though there are no Palestinians, there is no Palestine. That whole claim is a bluff and a hoax and a lie without any historic validity. But a so-called Palestinian state will be created in 90 to 97% of Judea and Samaria and in eastern Jerusalem. And then to make up for the fact that the PLO Fatah terrorists are getting only 90 to 97% of Judean Samaria instead of 100% like they demand, to compensate them for the fact that they're getting only 90 to 97% instead of 100% of Israel's biblical homeland, Israel will also surrender portions of the Negev Desert and of pre-1967 Israel to make sure that they're compensated and that they get the exact equivalent in land of what an Israeli retreat to the pre-67 borders would look like. That is what Netanyahu has agreed to as the basis of negotiations. His own cabinet ministers are saying he's very serious. He is really willing to go ahead with this. And none of us have any doubts that Barack Hussein Obama and John Kerry are going to brutally pressure Israel, are going to put on massive pressure, all the pressure they can put on, together with the Europeans, to get Netanyahu and the Israeli government to go along with this. Do any of you really believe that Netanyahu and the Israeli government will withstand brutal, obsessive pressure from the United States, Europe, and the whole world? Netanyahu has never withstood pressure at any time in his political career. He has always caved in. He has always capitulated. And so do any of you believe that now he's going to go against his whole history of always caving in, and that now he's going to stand up and he's going to stand strong against pressure from the whole world? Do any of you really believe that? Of course, you may say, well, maybe the Arab Muslim Nazis will rescue us by being too stupid to accept the agreement, which is something they did in the past. That happened in the past. God miraculously gave us enemies that are even dumber than the Jews. Yes, that's a miracle. To have people who are dumber than Jews is a miracle. Because the Jews may be brilliant when it comes to science and literature and art and medicine and inventions and discoveries. In those areas, the Jews are the most brilliant people on the face of the earth, by far. But when it comes to their own survival, they are so dumb and so stupid and so insane that words could never describe the extent of their lunacy. And so when God gives us Arab Muslim Nazi enemies that are even dumber than the Jews, even crazier than the Jews, And when the Arab Muslim Nazis say no to an agreement that would be the equivalent of Israeli national suicide, that truly is a miracle. That's God miraculously saving the Jews from their own insanity. And that is what happened in the Camp David agreements, the Camp David negotiations in the year 2000. In the year 2000, the Jew hater Bill Clinton was obsessively pressuring Israel nonstop, just as Obama and John Kerry are doing now. Bill and Hillary Clinton were doing that during the time they were in the White House. And they had gotten Ehud Barak, the Israeli prime minister at the time, to offer Arafat this agreement, to go back basically to the pre-1967 borders. And Arafat said no. I mean, that was a miracle. That was God intervening miraculously to save Israel from the insanity of her own leaders. Will that happen again? I hope, God willing, I hope so, but we are not allowed to depend on miracles. And I can tell you that there are growing voices in the Arab world and in Judea and Samaria that are saying, hey, wait a minute, if we're offered this again, this time we should say yes. This time we should accept it. There are people that are saying that now in the Arab world, that are getting wise enough to understand that if they would only say yes to this type of agreement, Israel would be cutting her own throat, God forbid. So there is a very real danger that this time the Arabs will say yes. And there is a very real danger that all of this will go through. As insane as it is, as unbelievable as it is, the danger does exist. If that happens, of course, as we have said before, the only hope for stopping it at that point will be for tens of thousands of Jews to block with their bodies, to block the Israeli retreats with their bodies. Because about 100,000 Jews would have to be expelled from their homes in order to effectuate this type of agreement. And in order to do that, in order to do that, if the Israeli army and Israeli police had to confront tens of thousands of Jews who were willing to get arrested, who were willing to resist, who were willing to physically use their bodies to block this type of surrender, that could save Israel. That is the one thing that could save Israel at that point. God forbid, I hope we never get to that point. But if we do, as we all know, JTF is the only organization, the only group that is consistently trying to wake up the Jews in Judea and Samaria, especially the young Jews, and say, if, God forbid, this happens, we must resist with our bodies. We have to block this surrender with our bodies, otherwise we're going to face national suicide. And so the danger is there. And by the way, while this danger of an agreement for Israeli national suicide, for an Israeli retreat to the pre-1967 borders, while this danger exists from the so-called negotiations, at the same time, another danger looms on the horizon, one that we've been warning about for over 20 years. Iran keeps getting closer and closer to building nuclear bombs, which of course creates the danger of a nuclear holocaust, and Netanyahu does nothing about that either. Why? Because Obama told him not to. Obama hasn't given him permission. He needs permission from Obama, from his boss Obama. He can't do anything without permission from Obama. He can't even save his people from a nuclear holocaust unless Obama says it's okay. This is the situation that we're in. Very, very dangerous. Very, very challenging situation. And I think you know what JTF does in this situation. We are not the only group now that is opposing what Netanyahu is doing. There are other groups that are against these negotiations. There are other groups in Israel now that oppose the release of the Muslim Nazi terrorists. We are not, on this issue, we're not the only ones. Even though, by the way, until we got to this point, we were the only ones. We were the only ones warning all along that this is what Netanyahu is going to do. We were the only ones warning all along that this danger exists. We were the only ones. Now that people see that we're really getting to a dangerous point here, other groups are beginning to speak out, and there are other people also that are protesting and trying to wake people up. So now we're one out of a number of groups that are working to wake the people of Israel up before it's too late. If these groups had been around, though, all along, and we hadn't been all alone, because we were all alone until this happened, if they had been around consistently as we are, year in and year out, day in and day out, warning the people of Israel, we wouldn't be in this situation. In any event, you know, every Jew and every righteous Gentile, every JTFer and all the people listening to this broadcast know that at a time like this, when Israel faces this type of national emergency, we are not allowed to be silent. We are not allowed to be apathetic or indifferent or silent. We're not allowed to put our own personal concerns and our own personal life ahead of the interests of Israel to the point where we don't care what happens to Israel. I'm not saying, by the way, that people should ignore things that happen in their own personal lives, but I am saying you are obligated to find time or to find money or to do something to protest and speak up and try to stop this. Every moral person is obligated to do something to try to stop this. JTF is trying to wake people up to stop this. We want to wake people up so that there will be massive resistance and so that they will not be able to carry out this plan. Plus, we want to wake up Israeli public opinion so that the politicians just aren't able to implement it, which, if Israeli public opinion is strongly enough against this, we can stop it, God willing. We're not allowed to be silent. We have to do everything we can to wake people up. We have to try our very best. And at least with JTF, you know that we are going to try our very best to reach as many people as possible and wake as many people up as possible, as quickly as possible, with the truth. And so, if you agree that that's important, if you agree we're not allowed to be silent, if you agree that we have to speak up, if you agree that we have to challenge injustice and challenge this insanity, if you agree that we have to bring the facts to people who don't have the facts and who don't understand the situation, or who've been, or Israeli Jews who've been brainwashed and maybe can be brought back to sanity, if you agree that it's important to try to reach people with this, then you have to help us. You have to help us when we put up Hebrew and English videos by liking, favoriting, commenting, sharing, and mirroring the videos on YouTube and on Facebook. If you like, favorite, comment, share, and mirror, you are enabling us to promote the videos on the YouTube, Facebook, and Google search engines. So help us with this. Help us do this. Every time you see us put up Hebrew and English videos, even if the video is in Hebrew and you don't understand Hebrew, help us. You can still help us promote the video. Very, very important. We need your help with that. Secondly, we need your help on our forum. If you speak Hebrew, on both of our forums, the Hebrew and the English forums. And on our Facebook pages. We want to make our forums and our Facebook pages as attractive as possible so that the thousands of people who visit our forums and visit our Facebook pages every week will want to join, will want to participate, will want to support us, will want to do something, will want to spread the word. We need your help to make the forums and to make the Facebook pages inviting and interesting places so that people will want to come back and will be interested and will learn things. So putting good threads, posting good threads and good announcements on the forums and on the Facebook pages, that's also important to us. And last but not least, of course we need your financial support. If we had a multi-million dollar budget, I'm telling you the situation would be different in Israel. I really believe that. I really believe this would be a different world. I really believe we could reach all the people of Israel with our message. If we had a multi-million dollar budget, I would be like the Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly of Israel. In other words, I would have a regular, set, huge audience. And with that regular, set, huge audience, we could really pose a tremendous challenge to the Israeli establishment, the Israeli government, and all the sellouts that are betraying the people of Israel, that run Israel today and that are traitors and that are betraying the people of Israel. And so we need your help but our problem is that we don't have a budget that's big enough to even begin to do that type of job. We're going to do the best we can with what we have. We are obligated to do the best we can with the resources that we have. But every check, money order, cash donation sent to our post office box, sent through the regular mail to our post office box, makes a big difference. It makes a difference. It does help. And, of course, if people prefer instead to do it online with their credit cards, they can go to the donate button on our English and Hebrew main pages on jtf.org or on hayamin.org. Click on the donate button and very conveniently they can help us with a credit card donation. Your donations make a difference. They enable us to reach more people. They enable us to bring facts to more people. They enable us to try to wake people up. Isn't that important? Isn't that something we're obligated to do? Shouldn't we be speaking out? Isn't it a disgrace that when there was a Holocaust 70 years ago, people did not speak out? Are we going to sit back and watch this type of thing again, God forbid? So if you agree that we have to speak out and you're happy that there's a group like JTF that at least tries its best to reach as many people with the real truth and the real facts, and you want to help us reach as many people as possible before it's too late, if you agree that's important, then help us. Okay, I think the events of the past week just show how important JTF really is, how important our Hebrew movement really is, how vital it is that we reach as many people as possible, that we convince as many people as possible, and that we try to confront this very dangerous situation. All right, let's get to our questions from our great JTFers this week. If I can get to them, one moment. Okay. And we start out with our good friend Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, what do you think of the pressure on Florida in getting rid of the stand your ground laws, unquote? Well, Joe, obviously I'm against getting rid of the stand your ground laws. I think the stand your ground laws are good laws. I think they should actually give even more flexibility, latitude, and rights to people defending themselves against criminals. People who want to defend themselves against criminals should be protected by the law. If a violent criminal wants to attack a law-abiding citizen, that law-abiding citizen should have the right to do whatever he has to do to defend himself. And so we're in favor of stand your ground laws. Thank you, Joe Gutfeld. And now we go to our good friend Yemach Shmor Wiener, who writes, and I quote, Dear Chaim, are Jews who continue to live in anti-Semitic countries like Poland, Turkey, Ukraine, etc., traitors, unquote? Yes, I think they are. Because if you work in those countries and do trade in those countries and pay taxes, that means you're assisting countries that have murdered millions of Jews, that have worked to destroy the Jewish people, that are still in favor of destroying the Jewish people. And I think that that is treason. How could you do something like that to your own people, to your own brothers and sisters? How could you be so oblivious to the fact that these people hate your guts and want to kill you, and have already murdered large numbers of your brothers and sisters? How could you be oblivious to that and just say, oh, I don't care, I want to continue to live and work and do business here? I mean, it's despicable. Yemach Shmor Wiener now writes, and I quote, P.S. Who do you think is more disgusting, Anthony Weiner or Elliot Spitzer, unquote? Oh, the two of them are equally disgusting. Anthony Weiner, of course, married to a Muslim who is involved with the terrorist Muslim Brotherhood. And he's a supporter of every evil cause under the sun. Barack Hussein Obama, pressure on Israel to commit suicide. He was involved with the Clintons. I mean, just the lowest, most disgusting, most vile traitor imaginable. And then Elliot Spitzer. Well, he's also an intermarried, self-hating piece of filth, who also supports all the left-wing causes, supports the destruction of his own people, an assimilated, intermarried, self-hating beast who's embarrassed to be Jewish. And this low-life rat, Elliot Spitzer, was the assistant district attorney in Robert Morgenthau's office in Manhattan when they decided not to prosecute the murderers of Rabbi Meir Kahana. Eventually, the feds did prosecute them because of what happened, because they bombed the World Trade Center. I mean, they went on to bomb the World Trade Center. But Elliot Spitzer was the lead associate district attorney in that office when the decision was made not to prosecute the murderers of Rabbi Kahana. So that's the type of unbelievable evil filth that Elliot Spitzer is. We certainly owe him. Yemach Shmo v'zichro. There's Anthony Weiner, Elliot Spitzer, Sheldon Silver. There's no difference between these self-hating Jewish traitors. If you've seen one, you've seen them all. They're all traitors, and they all have to be defeated. Thank you, Yemach Shmor Weiner. And now we go to the great Da Vinci, who writes, and I quote, Yoav Mordechai, the spokesman of the IDF, sent this year for the start of Ramadan best wishes to all the Muslims. Why is he doing such crazy things, unquote? Because you have it right, Da Vinci, because they're crazy. The IDF, the Israeli army, not only celebrates Ramadan and not only kisses the behind of all the Muslim terrorists, they tie the hands of Israeli soldiers. Their own soldiers, they send their own soldiers out to be slaughtered. They tie their hands and don't let their own soldiers defend themselves. They tell their own soldiers that you have to be willing to die but not hurt so-called Muslim terrorist civilians. If they're civilians, you can't hurt them. And you have this rule about if they shoot at you, you have to shoot at their legs. I mean, it's just unbelievable, crazy rules. Thousands of Israeli soldiers have lost their lives because of the politically correct, evil, treasonous rules of the Israeli army. Thousands of Israeli soldiers have been unnecessarily murdered because of that. So, That's what we're dealing with in Israel. And again, if we took power, of course, that would change. Then you'd have a real Jewish army that would deal with the Muslim Nazi enemy the way a real Jewish army is commanded to do in accordance with the commandments in the Bible. Thank you, Da Vinci. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, common sense, and logic, who writes, and I quote, "Please discuss the significance of Tu Be'av and how it differs from secular Valentine's Day," unquote. A great question, Dr. Dan. As always, a great question. Tu Be'av is the 15th day of the Hebrew month Av. And it's one of the happiest days on the Hebrew calendar. After the, you know, we had the sin of the spies when the Jews got out of Egypt. When the Hebrews got out of Egypt, they were going to go into the land of Israel right away. They were going to rebuild the Holy Temple. There was going to be eternal life. There was going to be redemption for the whole world immediately. But they did many sins. There were many sins in the Sinai Desert, and so that couldn't happen. And the worst sin probably in the Sinai Desert, the worst sin of all, was called Chet HaMeraglim. Chet HaMeraglim is the sin of the spies. The Jews send spies into the land of Israel in order to spy out the land so that they could liberate the land before attacking. And when the spies came back, they said, oh, it's a beautiful land. That's true. It's a land of milk and honey. It's a land that flows with milk and honey. It's a beautiful land. But they said, the people who inhabit the land are like giants, and we're like grasshoppers, and we can't do it, and it's impractical, and we just can't do it. And all of the Jews in Israel, after seeing all the miracles in Egypt, after seeing what God did for them, listened to the spies and said, oh, we have to go back to Egypt. We have no choice. They were ready to go back to slavery in Egypt. They didn't believe Hashem. They didn't believe in God after what he did for them in the 10 plagues and crossing the Red Sea and all the unbelievable miracles. They still didn't believe. And so God said, because of this sin, you are not going to go back to Israel for 40 years. You're going to wander the desert for 40 years before you go back to Israel. Until this generation that is responsible for this sin dies. And when we speak about this generation, all the males, all the men, from the ages of 20 to 60, were sentenced to die in the Sinai Desert rather than go back to Israel. They had to wander for 40 years until they died out and were replaced by the new generation. And the new generation then would go to Israel. That was the sentence that God passed against the Jews for the terrible sin of the spies. The women, by the way, were not part of this punishment. Only the men were going to be punished. The men aged 20 to 60, and there were 600,000 of them. The women were not part of the punishment because the women were not part of the sin of the spies. The women did not agree with the spies. The women wanted to liberate the land of Israel. The women were loyal to Hashem. Because of righteous women, the Jewish people were saved over and over again during this generation. And this was a generation where the women were very righteous. And because of righteous women, the Jews were saved over and over again. It was the men that were doing all the sinning here. The same thing with the sin of the golden calf. The women did not participate in the sin of the golden calf. That was the men. The women were righteous. In any event, the men from ages 20 to 60 were sentenced to die. That was 600,000 men. And what God did is he said, every year, when you reach the age of 60, every year, you're going to die. And you divide 600,000 by 40 years. If you divide 600,000 by 40, you get 15,000. So 15,000 of the Hebrews from the ages of 20 to 60, 15,000 were dying every year. That was the punishment. That's how God, and they'd be replaced, of course, by the new generation. But they 15,000 would pass away from that generation, from the old generation, and the new generation would replace them. And at the end of 40 years, they all would be replaced. On Tu Be'av, on the 40th year, when the last 15,000 were left, You had 585,000 were already passed away over 39 years of wandering in the desert. They'd been wandering in the desert for 39 years, and 585,000 Jews already had died and had been replaced by the younger generation. And only 15,000 from the generation was left, and it was their time to die. On Tu Be'av, we discovered for certainty that the last 15,000 were not going to die, that God decided to grant them a reprieve and decided that they would be allowed to enter the land of Israel after all. The last 15,000 would not be punished. God decided in his mercy not to carry out the punishment for the last 15,000. So Tu Be'av, when these last 15,000 discovered that they were going to live and they were going to be able to go into the land of Israel together with the younger generation, that was a very happy day for them, obviously, and for their families. They were all very happy. So Tu Be'av was the day when we discovered that the punishment of the spies was over, that God had forgiven the Jews for the sin of the spies, and the punishment of the spies was now over. There's another reason why Tu Be'av is a very happy day. We also were forgiven for the sin of the golden calf on that day, another very serious sin. Moses goes up and brings down the Torah. He's up for 40 days and 40 nights, and when he comes down, he sees the Jews are worshiping a golden calf. Very serious sin. In any event, we were forgiven for the sin of the golden calf as well on Tu Be'av. So we're forgiven for the two biggest sins, the sin of the golden calf and the sin of the spies on Tu Be'av. And the sin of the golden calf in Hebrew was called Chet Ha'egel. And so this is a good and blessed day to create Jewish couples for marriage. Jews that have a hard time finding their mate, this is a good day to find their mate. This is a good day when Jewish men can find the women in their lives, the women that they want in their lives, and Jewish women can find the men that they need in their lives for marriage. It's an excellent day for that. It's a good and blessed day. It's one of the happiest days on the Hebrew calendar. Now, as far as Valentine's Day is concerned, that is actually a holiday with pagan origins. Jews are forbidden to celebrate it because it has pagan origins. And you can't separate the pagan aspect from the secular aspect. The concept of Valentine's Day is a pagan concept. Jews are not allowed to celebrate Valentine's Day. And they don't have to. They could celebrate Tu Be'av. Tu Be'av is the day for Jewish love and Jewish couples. And it's a beautiful day. It's a beautiful day in Jewish history and a day with great Jewish tradition. Thank you so much, Dr. Dan, for a great question. And now we go to, let me just check something here to make sure everything's going okay. Yes, it does. It seems to be going okay. And now we go to our good friend Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, "Is God using the Muslims to punish and or destroy Europe?" Unquote. Oh, there's no doubt that the Muslim invasion of Europe is a punishment. Now, Europe, for 2,000 years, murdered millions of Jews. They murdered and tortured God's people for 2,000 years. That's a fact. In the Inquisitions, the pogroms, the Crusades, the expulsions, the blood libels, and finally the Holocaust. I mean, this is something that they did to the Jewish people for 20 centuries. And of course, they destroyed ancient Israel as well. I mean, it was just the history is just a horrific history. And to this day, they haven't changed. Look what they're doing now. They're pressuring Israel to commit suicide. They're doing everything they can. They're boycotting Israel. They're doing everything they can to destroy Israel even now. And so, yes, and this is this plague that has beset Europe. This punishment, there's no question that the Muslim invasion of Europe is a punishment and may lead to the destruction of Europe eventually. Binyamin Yisrael now writes, and I quote, "Will America be punished for FDR's role in the Holocaust?" Unquote. Absolutely. as a result of what Roosevelt and the United States did during the Holocaust. 6 million Jews were murdered. The Holocaust could have been stopped. Could have been stopped. But Roosevelt and the United States refused to bomb the rail lines leading to Auschwitz, refused to bomb the concentration camps. Of course there's going to be punishment for that. Of course God's not going to sit back and just ignore the murder of over 6 million of his people. God says in the Bible, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. That's what he told Moses to tell Pharaoh. God loves the Jewish people, despite the fact that they're a very difficult people. But he loves the Jewish people. And he chose the Jewish people to be a light unto the nations and a holy nation and a nation of priests. Anyone who goes against the Jews is attacking God. It's like attacking God. It's attacking his children. And so anyone who had a role in enabling 6 million Jews to be murdered during the Holocaust, of course there's going to be punishment for that. Thank you, Binyamin Yisrael. And now we go to the great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, "What do you think about immigration from Asian countries?" Unquote. I think that Asians are productive people, generally speaking. They have decent neighborhoods. They raise decent families. Their children go to schools and actually perform better academically than white children do. When you say Asian countries, by the way, I'm not referring, of course, to Muslim countries and Pakistan and Afghanistan and countries like that. I'm not referring to the Muslims. But when you speak about Asian countries, if you're referring to countries like China, their children actually perform better in school academically than white kids. So, you know, I don't have any problem with them as immigrants from the standpoint of their economic success. The one thing that does concern me and that bothers me is that they vote liberal, they vote left-wing Democrat. They voted for Obama overwhelmingly. The Asian Americans voted overwhelmingly for Obama, together with Hispanics and, of course, blacks. So that's very problematic. If they're going to come here and they're going to vote overwhelmingly left-wing Democrat, that's a problem. And yes, of course, I know my own people, my fellow Jews, unfortunately, voted overwhelmingly for Obama. It's also disgraceful, and I'm ashamed of that. I'm embarrassed. It's a disgrace. It's a crime that they voted for Obama. But I don't want to add to the problem and have more millions of new Obama voters come into the country. So that's a problem. That's a serious problem. I don't have a problem with them in terms of the neighborhoods they create. They create nice neighborhoods. They create good families. They have family values. My problem with them, again, is just how they vote when they go into the polling places. That's something that disturbs me, and that's crazy, because Obama can't stand Asians. Obama's jealous of Asians. Black people generally are jealous of Asians because Asians achieve well academically. Blacks live here four centuries, and their IQ is only half the IQ of Asians. So, you know, obviously there's tremendous jealousy there. And now Tag Mechir Tzedek writes, and I quote, "If you had to guess, how many years would you give America before it goes bankrupt?" Unquote. That's hard for me to say. I think America might become third world before it goes bankrupt. I think America actually might become a third world banana republic even before it goes bankrupt. America is close to the tipping point now, where it's going to be too late to stop. We saw in the last election there was a majority for Obama. In the past two elections, Obama got a majority. So we may be past the tipping point already, where a majority of Americans already are on the left. And because you have the so-called minorities and the left-wing whites, together they already make up a majority of the voters, that we already may be in that type of nightmare scenario, that nightmare situation in the United States. If that's true, that's even worse than going bankrupt. Then America's finished if that's true. Hopefully, something will happen to wake up America's white majority and to create a sense of sanity once again. Hopefully. hopefully, maybe something can still happen to do that. Maybe if Obamacare and the Obama administration and Obama policies fail so miserably, maybe finally enough white voters will wake up and enough people in general will wake up so that we can reverse these policies. I hope so. Thank you, Tag Mechir Tzedek. And now we go to... And by the way, Tag Mechir Tzedek, you know, demographically, America is now like 62 or 63% white. 62, 63% of America is white now. So the majority of babies born in the United States now are not white. So third world people are on their way to becoming a majority. There's no question about it. And it's coming very fast. It's coming very fast. So unless something happens that completely changes the situation dramatically, America's future is sealed. Unless something happens that really turns the situation around. Thank you, Tag Mechir. And now we go to our good friend Obama is trash, who writes, and I quote, one, Helen Thomas is dead, unquote. Baruch Hashem, thank God that that beast is dead. Unfortunately, she lived a very long life, which means we have an evil generation. God punishes us and allows evil people to live long lives when there's an evil generation. Also, you know, it's interesting. So many of these Jewish reporters, all the self-hating Jewish reporters, I forgot what her name, I'm trying to think of the name of that animal. There's one in particular that I'm trying to think of. She's married to Alan Greenspan. Anyway, hopefully it'll come to me. I mean, I could look it up right now. But she wrote an article talking about how much she misses Helen Thomas. How Helen Thomas was such a pioneer. Praising Helen Thomas. Helen Thomas said that all the Jews should get the hell out of Israel and go home to Germany. I mean, she was an Arab, an ugly Arab dog, who called for genocide against the Jews. In every press conference, she asked questions against Israel. She was a Nazi, an Arab, ugly Arab Nazi dog. And you have all these self-hating Jewish politicians mourning her death. That shows you what and self-hating Jewish reporters. All the self-hating Jewish reporters. Andrea Mitchell, by the way. The name of that animal, that reporter, is Andrea Mitchell. She's married to Alan Greenspan. Oh, is she a self-hating Jew? Oh, is she an animal? She's also, by the way, she's another one who's so ugly beyond belief. She's ugly. Her husband's ugly. You know, oh, just disgusting people. She had to write a whole thing about how wonderful Helen Thomas is. Helen Thomas, who wants to kill her and destroy the whole Jewish people, and this self-hating Jew is writing about how much she loves Helen Thomas. And Obama is trash now writes, and I quote, two, are Chechen Muslims a curse for Russia's lifelong anti-Semitism, unquote. I think so. I think that Russia's getting a lot of curses for their lifelong anti-Semitism. Not only the Muslims, they're getting it. They're getting many, many different things. I mean, just look at the situation in Russia. I mean, Russia's situation economically, socially, technologically is a nightmare. Russia is a nightmare. Technologically, they are light years behind the United States and the Western world. I mean, just it's a joke. And the only thing that has saved them really is the fact that they discovered oil and natural gas, that they have oil and natural gas that they're able to export to Europe. If not for the oil and natural gas, Russia would be facing bankruptcy. Russia would be like a third world country. Anyway, Obama is trash now writes, and I quote, three, give a Yamach Shmoru Bushido, a Muslim Nazi rapper from Berlin, unquote. Absolutely, Yamach Shmo V'Zichro Shem Reshaim Yirkav, may his name and memory be obliterated, may the name of the wicked rot. He's the guy who wrote the, if I'm not mistaken, he's also written and said things against Israel, and he calls himself a gangster. He's another one with the gangster rap. And I mean, he lives in Germany. I believe he was born in Germany, if I'm correct. I think he's half Arab and half German. His mother is German, and his father is a Tunisian Arab. And he is just, what a lowlife, immoral animal, singing about raping women and just, I mean, just a vile, immoral piece of filth. Just a piece of filth. Thank you, Obama's trash. And now we go to our good friend Chicago Jew, who writes, and I quote, "Were you as surprised as I was that Alan Dershowitz is siding with George Zimmerman? See you in 3 weeks," unquote. Alan Dershowitz is all over the place. I mean, he sometimes takes this side on this issue and that side on another issue. You know, his positions, though, the other positions he's taken on issues over the years are so evil. Don't forget, he was part of the legal team that got O.J. Simpson acquitted. Alan Dershowitz was a legal advisor and helped the legal team that got O.J. Simpson acquitted. So he helped O.J. Simpson get off. Alan Dershowitz, of course, also said that he would have represented Adolf Hitler and gotten him off. That was one of his quotes, because even Hitler deserves legal representation, and I would have gotten him off. And Alan Dershowitz, I mean, can you imagine a Jew saying he would have represented Hitler and gotten him off? You can't get more evil than that. You just can't. And I could give you so many other instances of the despicable nature of this individual. So the fact that he occasionally gets one right, that doesn't redeem him in my eyes. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And now we go to the great paper cut, who writes, and I quote, "Chaim, can you please talk about Bernard Goetz? And is he the George Zimmerman of the 1980s? Unquote. In many ways he is, yes. Bernard Goetz was a white guy, actually half, I hate to say half Jewish, because under Jewish law, you can't be half pregnant. You're either Jewish or you're not Jewish. I don't think he was halachically Jewish, but I think, I forgot what part of his family, a part of his family was Jewish. In any event, Bernard Goetz is a guy that gets on the subway. A white guy, four blacks with sharpened screwdrivers and other tools of the trade surround him and demand money from him. They try to shake him down and mug him on the subway. He pulls out a gun and shoots them. And he injures two of them. I think two of them are actually injured for life. I think one of them is crippled. He injures two of them. And the other two run away. He, of course, is charged with second-degree murder by the Manhattan District Attorney, the evil Manhattan District Attorney that wouldn't charge the murderers of Rabbi Meir Kahana, except for the trigger man, El Sayyid Nosair. They wouldn't charge Rabbi Kahana's murderers, even though they had overwhelming evidence against them. They refused to charge them with anything. But the same left-wing, self-hating Jews of the Manhattan DA's office charged Bernard Goetz with second-degree murder. So Bernard Goetz was facing 25 years to life. I'm sorry, it wasn't second-degree murder, it was attempted murder. And I think he was facing 8 1/4 to 25 years. He was facing up to 25 years on each count. And there were four counts of attempted murder, and then there were other counts. So he was facing a very, very long time in prison. He wound up being acquitted on all counts, except for illegal possession of the gun. And he got 6 months in prison on that charge. He did actually get 6 months in prison. So he didn't get acquitted completely as George Zimmerman did. And he didn't actually kill these vicious beasts the way George Zimmerman did. So I actually like the George Zimmerman story better, because George Zimmerman got rid of this degenerate, antisocial piece of filth. So, you know, I mean, I thought the George Zimmerman story ended on a more positive note. There was more of a happy ending to the George Zimmerman story, in my opinion. But still, Bernard Goetz was certainly someone who did the right thing and who deserved to be supported by the public. Thank you, Papercut. And now we go to the great Dan Ben Noach, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, who would you choose as chief rabbi of Israel today, unquote? Well, it wouldn't be any of the people who ran in the recent election, Dan Ben Noach. I would probably choose Harav Ido Elba. Why? Because he is a Jewish hero who actually sat in jail for 2 years because he wrote a book telling the truth about what Jews are supposed to do to the Arab enemy, according to halacha, according to Jewish law. The Shabak arrested him. He refused to cooperate, refused to answer questions, and they put him in prison for 2 years, and he refused to answer questions for 2 whole years. I would make him the chief rabbi of Israel. And Dan Ben Noach now writes, what do you think of Rabbi Ratzon Arusi? Rabbi Ratzon Arusi, he's an establishment guy. I mean, I don't know anything that terrible about him. I don't know all of his history. But he was one of the people who ran. He's an establishment guy. He's part of the establishment. And, you know, even if you're a local chief rabbi, if you're part of the establishment, that's bad. The establishment in Israel is evil. The religious establishment, the political establishment, the social establishment. The establishment is run by bad people in Israel. And we've got to replace them. We've got to replace all of them. By the way, I would eliminate the office of chief rabbi. I don't think there's a need for a chief rabbi. What is a chief rabbi holier than the other rabbis? I would eliminate this office. It's a waste of taxpayer dollars. It's a disgrace. And many of the so-called chief rabbis are immoral charlatans. I mean, we've seen some of them corrupt and facing indictment and facing all types of terrible charges and scandals. Yeah, this is an office that shouldn't even exist. Anyway, great question as always, Dan Ben Noach. And now we go to our good friend Yemach Shmo Lewinsky. And let's leave it at that. Yemach Shmo Lewinsky writes, and I quote, unfortunately, the Nazi dyke Christine Quinn, Yemach Shma V'Zichra, is quite attractive, and being childless is youthful. Is this reality a test to us from Satan, unquote? Yemach Shmo Lewinsky, I don't think she's attractive. I really don't think so. I mean, I don't find her attractive. And you say because she's childless, she's youthful. You know, I know some women age when they have children, but some of them remain quite youthful and beautiful after having many children. I actually know Jewish women in Judea and Samaria who have 6, 7, 8, 9 children, are beautiful women, and they're beautiful. So I'm not sure that having children ages you. I'm not sure about that. I don't know. Maybe in some cases it does. I don't think it does in every case. And Christine Quinn, in my opinion, is not attractive. As far as being tested from Satan, you know, let's face it, the voters in New York City are evil. Most of them are evil, horrible people. New York City voted 81% for Barack Hussein Obama. So what type of city is this? This is a horrific, disgusting city, a city with tremendous wealth, tremendous power. Wall Street is in New York City. Most of the entertainment industry have their headquarters here, even though the filming industry is in Hollywood. But the networks, the TV networks, and the Broadway shows, and most of the music industry is here in New York City. It's the cultural center of the world. You have the hideous United Nations in New York City. You have most of the big corporate headquarters in New York City, you have more corporate, international corporate headquarters in New York City than in any other city in the world by far. And what does the city do with all of these material blessings? They support Obama. They have a mayor like Mike Bloomberg, who is a crypto-fascist. I mean, it's just a hideous, hideous place. Horrible. They have the highest taxes in the country in New York City. The most politically correct pieces of garbage run every single department in New York City. So I'm not surprised that Christine Quinn and even Anthony Weiner, he was a front runner until the latest revelations destroyed his candidacy. But before then, the polls were showing he was a front runner. It was helping him that he did what he did on the, you know, what he was doing, sending nude pictures of himself to young women. This in New York City, that was a plus. Just like the fact that Christine Quinn is a lesbian, an admitted lesbian who is married, quote unquote, to another woman. In New York City, that's a plus. You have another candidate called Bill de Blasio. I don't know if his name is de Blasio. Bill de Blasio. His wife is a black lesbian. Yeah, she's a black woman who, when she was a teenager, wrote an article admitting that she's a lesbian. I don't know why she married him, if she's a lesbian, but she married him. And his wife is a black lesbian, and he's running around all over the city saying, wait a minute, my wife is a black lesbian. Because among New York City voters, that's an advantage. So this is just a horrible, horrible city. A horrible place in a horrible city. And people have free will. People want to be evil, they could be evil. It's unfortunate, but that's unfortunately what you have in this city. Thank you, Yamach Shmota Lewinsky. Okay. And now we go to the great spiraling leopard who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, please pray for a just outcome of my court case, which will be held this Thursday. Thank you, Robert. Unquote. Absolutely, Robert. I certainly will pray. I pray that you win the case decisively. All the people that went to court against you should drop dead, should die of every disease known to man. Yimach shmam v'zichram to all the evil people that are going against you in court. You should be blessed and protected, and you should win your case, absolutely. And all of us should pray that Robert wins his case in court. Robert is a really saintly, wonderful, righteous person, and we absolutely want him to win his court case, no question about it. And we don't have to know details about your case. You can trust me when I tell you that his case is that he is being it's an unjust he's be, an injustice is being done to him, and we should pray that he win and win decisively. Thank you, Robert. God bless you. And now we go to Mariah, who I'm sorry, it's Maria. Is it Maria or Mariah? I'm not sure. I'm gonna try Maria. Maria, who is new on the forum. Welcome to the forum, and I apologize if I didn't pronounce your name correctly. Welcome to the forum. Maria writes, and I quote, I love getting emails telling me about the latest message on JTF, but when I come here, I never know where to find the message, unquote. Maria, the message that we have comes in a number of places. It comes through our videos. It comes through the messages on our forum. You read the threads on our forum. That's part of our message. And it comes through these programs, the SJTF programs. And it comes through our Facebook pages. We've got three Facebook pages in English. So we have the Facebook pages, the forum, the SJTF shows, and the YouTube videos. That's how we transmit our message. Thank you so much, Maria, and again, welcome to JTF. It's great to have you. And now we go to the great Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, do you believe that polygamy and other currently unacceptable forms of sexuality will soon become culturally acceptable, unquote? Oh, of course. Of course. It's going to come to the point where anything anybody wants to do will be acceptable. Bestiality, pedophilia, all these things, God forbid, will become fully acceptable. You know, once you say that gay marriage is acceptable, that opens the door to everything. It opens the door to everything. And, you know, we should have known that this was going to happen when we started in the 1960s. you know, with what was called then the sexual revolution, that that was going to lead to all, you know, in the 1960s, when the sexual revolution started, you had religious people, including evangelical Christians and Orthodox Jews and others, who said, you know, this is going to lead eventually to the acceptance of homosexuality. In the 60s, homosexuality was universally considered to be a mental illness. So everybody said, no way, how can you compare that? We're talking about normal heterosexual sex. We're talking about freedom for heterosexual couples to do whatever they want. We're not talking about homosexuality. That's perverted. That's people of the same sex. That's not normal. And no way will it lead to that. And they said, eventually, that's going to become acceptable. And look what happened. Everything will become acceptable. God forbid, if we continue down this path. Unless something happens to wake people up and turn the tide, everything, God forbid, will become acceptable. And this will be a miserable, horrible world if that happens. Thank you, Maimonides. And now we go to the great Mishmat, who writes, and I quote, Chaim, may you discuss the latest insanity involving Netanyahu, unquote. Well, Mishmat, I actually did discuss that. That was my entire opening this week and last week. So actually, I did cover that. I did cover that already. But you read my mind, as you often do, and you knew what I was going to discuss. And I thank you for that, for the question. But Mishmat also has a second question. And that is also a Dvar Torah on this week's parasha, Kol Tuv. Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you, Mishmat. Mishmat wants me to discuss this week's Torah portion, this week's portion of the Torah that we read, which is called the Parasha. And this week's Parasha is Parashat Ekev. There are many interesting aspects to this week's Torah portion, but there's one in particular that stands out for me. And that is where it says, Kochi ve'etzem yadi asali et hachayil hazeh. Which means, my strength and the power of my hand gave me this ability, gave me this achievement. In effect, that's in effect what it's saying. Not literally, but in effect what it's saying. It's difficult, by the way, to translate directly from Hebrew to English because words have different, especially biblical Hebrew. But kochi ve'etzem yadi asali et ha'chayil hazeh, it basically means through my power and my wisdom and my talent and my ability, I achieved what I achieved. That's basically what it's trying to say. And you know, the rabbis actually say that that's not a bad thing. That people should understand that through their own power, and through their own effort, and through their own initiative, you're going to achieve things. You're not supposed to sit back and wait for God to do things for you miraculously. You're not allowed to. You're not allowed to sit and pray all day and ask God to do all the work for you. There's no point in our existing in this world if we're going to do that. Now, there are some Haredi Jews who say, well, what do you mean? We're put in this world to pray. And we just should pray. But that's not, you clearly see all the great figures in the Bible, all the great figures in Jewish history, were not just people who just prayed. They acted. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, took the initiative against Pharaoh and acted. He didn't just pray. I mean, with the parting of the Red Sea and the 10 plagues and everything that was done in the Sinai, it was not just prayer. There was constant action involved there. And the same thing we see with Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the three fathers of the Jewish people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we see that they didn't just pray, they acted. And we see the same thing, of course, with King David. So we are required to do things, to be like God's partners in this world. Of course, without God's help, we can't succeed. Without God's help, we have no chance of succeeding. But we have to take the first steps, and we have to act, and we have to do everything we can, everything within our power, everything within our natural means we have to do to achieve whatever we want to achieve, to correct things and make this a better world. We have to do everything we can. And then we have to also pray to God to help us. So there has to be both prayer and action. Both. One doesn't replace the other, and one is not in place of the other. Both. We have to do as much, we have to do as much as we can in terms of action, and as much prayer as we can after we've done the action. Both. Each one is essential. If we do both, then we're fulfilling our role in this world. And I think that's what it means when it says in this week's parasha, Kochi ve'etzem yadi asali et hachayil hazeh. My strength and the strength of my hand gave me this achievement. I think that that's really what the parasha is trying to tell us. Thank you, Mishmat. And now we go to our friend Christians for Jews, who writes, and I quote, "Is there a correct way of breathing that we as adults have neglected, and how can we change this?" Unquote. Well, there's a healthier way of breathing, and that's through the nose, if you can. If you can breathe through your nose, there are filters in your nose. There are filters in your nostrils. And so you get less of the infectious things that are running around in the atmosphere and in the air. And the filters make your breathing a healthier experience. When you open your mouth and breathe through your mouth, there are fewer filters in your mouth. There's much less of an ability to filter air in your mouth, because the nose and the nostrils are really what were intended for breathing. The mouth, of course, was intended primarily for eating. And so breathing through your nose and through your nostrils is healthier than breathing through your mouth, if possible. Some people, it's hard for them just to breathe through their nostrils, but if you can, it's healthier. Thank you, Christians for Jews. And now we go to the great EB22, who writes, and I quote, "Please discuss the New York Federation UJA decision to boycott Judea and Samaria, the ramifications, and what should be done to counter UJA," unquote. Well, we should boycott UJA. We always have been in favor of boycotting the UJA. The UJA, which calls itself the United Jewish Appeal, is really the United Jihad Appeal. They have always been the worst self-hating Jews, the worst assimilated, evil, self-hating scum on the face of the earth. That is the fundraising mechanism for the Jewish establishment, the Federation, UJA Federation. So it's no surprise that these criminal beasts also boycott Judea and Samaria. Of course they do. You know, everybody in Israel complains about the Europeans are boycotting Judea and Samaria. Meanwhile, you've got the biggest Jewish fundraising organization in America that also boycotts Judea and Samaria. Look how self-hating, how disgusting, how evil the Jewish establishment is in this country. The Jewish establishment, by the way, is B'nai B'rith, the Anti-Defamation League, the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, Hadassah. These organizations are evil. Evil. They promote evil in Israel. They promote evil in the American Jewish community. They promote evil everywhere. And the Orthodox Jewish organizations that work with them and cooperate with them are also promoting evil. You know how you countered UJA? You boycott UJA, number one. And number two, instead you give to JTF. People should give to JTF and support JTF instead of UJA. That's what they should do. If we had 1% of UJA's budget, we could save the world. With 1% of UJA's budget, we would be a mass movement in Israel. And by saving Israel, the saving of Israel would lead to saving the world eventually. Thank you, EB22. And now we go to our good friend Gimatria, who writes, and I quote, "Chaim Gibor Dorenu, tell us of Shalom Simchon," unquote. Shalom Simchon is a left-wing politician in Israel who used his positions as a cabinet minister and as a Knesset member to enrich himself. Even the inspector, the Israeli inspector general, if you want to call it that, Mevaker HaMedina, they call it in Israel, or the state inspector, and that's a leftist institution, even he said that this guy, Shalom Simchon, was promoting his own businesses and his own family business interests while he was a cabinet minister. He was trying to destroy family farms in Israel and promote big corporate farming because his family is involved in big corporate farming. So he's a corrupt, sleazy, money-grubbing, left-wing lowlife. And those are his good qualities. And now we go to the next question from Gematria, which is, and I quote, why was Chaim Amsalem kicked out of Shas, unquote. Well, because Amsalem had his own agenda, by the way. He is just as evil as Shas is. Shas is a corrupt, evil party. And this guy is just as evil. This guy was part of the Geneva, Yozmat Geneva, the Geneva Project. He was part of that. He supports the Geneva Project. What is a Geneva Project? The Geneva Project is a project that says that Israel not only should go back to the pre-1967 suicidal borders, not only should surrender Jerusalem, their capital city, but should also accept Arab refugees into Israel. In other words, it's a call for the destruction of Israel as a Jewish state. And this pig, who calls himself a religious Jew and calls himself a rabbi. If he's a rabbi, I'm a Shiite imam if he's a rabbi. He was part of what was called Yozmat Geneva, the Geneva Project. So, just complete scum. And Shas is also scum. I mean, the Shas party, that's also disgusting, corrupt, vile, blood-sucking party. And now Gematria writes, and I quote, why did Meir Shitrit join Hatnua, unquote. Well, Meir Shitrit is a leftist, and Hatnua is a left-wing party. Meir Shitrit, by the way, was one of the interior ministers Meir Shitrit is a guy who, first of all, was one of the people who rejected my Aliyah applications when the chief rabbi of Israel appealed to him to enable me to make Aliyah. He wrote back an angry letter to the chief rabbi of Israel saying, what are you talking about? This filthy criminal, this criminal, this is who you want to help? The same Meir Shitrit who supported the Arab Hitler Yasser Arafat. The Arab Hitler Yasser Arafat, he welcomed into Israel with open arms. But Chaim ben Pesach is a criminal because Chaim ben Pesach fought to free Soviet Jews. That's Meir Shitrit, Yimach Shmo V'Zechro Shem Reshaim Yirkav. And the party that he joined, Hatnua, is a party of left-wing criminals. Thank you, Gematria. And now, one moment. Okay. And now we go to, where was Chris Hansen in the 7th century, who writes, and I quote, 1. Should the train driver in Spain get the death penalty, unquote. I don't know all the details of what happened, but it appears he was speeding. He was going double the speed limit. So that was very reckless behavior, and 78 people were killed. I think in a situation like that, someone should get the death penalty. I really do. I mean, when you're reckless and your reckless actions lead to 78 people being killed, I mean, shouldn't somebody have to pay with their life? For doing something so reckless, so irresponsible, and so devastating. We're talking about the accident on the train accident in Spain this past week, where 78 people were killed because this train driver is going double the speed limit, and the train went off the tracks, and 78 people paid with their lives. And now, next question 2: have you read the New Testament? Unquote. Yes, I have. And 3, next question, 3, describe your family's experience in Egypt, unquote. Well, my family went to Egypt from Spain. Some of them went to Morocco, some of them went to Egypt. They originally lived in Spain. My mother's maiden name is Khazdai, and they originally lived in Spain. They were actually a pretty famous family in Spain before the Inquisition. And then because of the Spanish Inquisition, they had to leave because if you didn't convert, you were being burned alive. They were literally putting Jews on the stake and burning them alive. if they were unwilling to convert in Spain. That was the Inquisition, and torturing people, brutally torturing people in the worst way. And thousands of Jews, by the way, were actually burned alive in the Inquisition on orders from the church in Spain, Portugal, Italy, and other Brazil and other Catholic countries. Thousands of Jews were burned alive. So my family had to leave. Some of them went to Morocco and some of them went to Egypt. In Egypt, they lived in Alexandria for centuries. And my understanding is that there were times when, you know, first of all, when they went there, initially the Muslims were still in charge of Egypt. But the Muslims were using the Jews at that time. Muslim rulers in Turkey and Egypt and other countries wanted the Jews to come into their countries because they wanted Jewish brains and they wanted the Jews to help them because they were in a struggle at that time against Christian Europe. And so they were willing to have a Jewish minority and tolerate a Jewish minority as part of their struggle against Christian Europe. Then it wasn't that they tolerated, that they really tolerated Jews. They hated the Jews, but they were willing to work with them for that reason, because of their self-interest. Then, of course, the European colonialists took over the Muslim world, took over most of the Muslim world, and the British took over Egypt. When the British were in Egypt, Jews were able to open businesses, and my family actually had a business. They actually had a store in Alexandria, a big store. The British I don't know if they protected, but under British rule, the Jews were able to do these things. Then, when the British were finally thrown out, and the Muslims took over, and the Muslims got independence, and Israel came into being in 1948, the situation for Jews in Egypt became impossible, and almost all the Jews left. There are now fewer than 100 Jews living in Egypt. There was once a big Jewish community in Egypt. In fact, in ancient times, in really ancient times, you had a huge Jewish community in Egypt. Hundreds of thousands of Jews lived there. It was a big Jewish community in ancient times. But because of Muslim-Jew hatred, the Jews, virtually all of them, finally left. And my family left before Israel came into being. My family saw the writing on the wall, saw that it was going to become impossible for the Jews to survive there, so they left. But before then, when the British colonialists were still running the country, they actually had stores there. They actually had a store there, and they went to school there, and they had separate Jewish schools and like a separate Jewish community. The Jews lived among themselves. They didn't go to school together with the Muslims. They lived among themselves, so they were able to educate their children. And you know, when the British colonialists were there, the situation for them was tolerable. But eventually they left and got out of there. You know, after the State of Israel was created in 1948 and the Egyptians eventually threw the British out of Egypt, Nasser, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, the dictator of Egypt, took all of the Jews in Egypt, men, women, and children, even little babies, and put them all in Egyptian prison. He accused all thousands of Egyptian Jews. He accused all of them. My family was not among them. My family had left already. But he accused all the Jews of Egypt of being spies for Israel. He said, all the Jews in Egypt are spies for Israel. And he put, there were about 2,500 or 3,000 Jews left in Egypt at that time. He put all of them in prison, including little babies, put them all in prison, said, you're all spies for Israel. In the end, he eventually released them and let them leave Egypt because he didn't want to. And the reason they didn't slaughter the Jews in Egypt and let them leave is because they didn't want to hurt their propaganda campaign against Israel. They were claiming that if the Jews just leave Israel and go back to the countries they came from, everything's going to be fine. So obviously it would have looked terrible if Egypt started slaughtering all of the Egyptian Jews. That would have looked awful. It would not have looked like what they're saying in their propaganda campaign is truthful. So for propaganda reasons, they decided not to slaughter all the Jews, but Nasser did put them all in prison and was holding them hostage, thousands of them hostage, and putting them in prison and accusing them all of being Israeli spies. And if not for the fact that they wanted to score propaganda points against Israel, they would have slaughtered every last Jew there, the way they want to slaughter all the Jews in Israel. Thank you. Where was Chris Hansen in the 7th century? And I want to thank all of our great JTFers for another show that I very much enjoyed doing. Until next week, shalom.